Welcome into a Thursday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We are talking the Brooklyn Nets' best win post-All-Star break, 119-111 over the poorly coached, extremely talented Milwaukee Bucks. Let's get to it.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
You are listening to the Locked On Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I am your host, Gavin Shaw. After 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns, who got a big boost tonight because the Bucks lost, and that makes it more likely they will keep their pick. So shout out to the Nets-Suns synergy. And I am also an epitome of that, as I went from covering the Phoenix Suns to moving back to my native New York to covering the Brooklyn Nets. Josh incapacitated tonight, so I got friend of the show Jeremy Caplet, who is, I guess, relatively unqualified to talk about basketball. Very, very smart guy, though. Did really well on his SATs. And is a big fan of hoops, a big fan of the Nets, and most importantly, a big fan of this podcast, which is the most important quality in determining who gets to come on. So, Jeremy, I welcome you into your Locked On Nets debut.
And more importantly, very excited to make my debut as a blog boy.
Yeah, no, that's the biggest thing. You gotta live that blog boy lifestyle, and I know you epitomize that. Jeremy spending long hours at home, staying up late into the night, reading NBA Reddit. You have all the qualities of a great blog boy, and I'd like to say I saw the potential in you from day one, and that's why you're here today.
Thank you. As someone who's more of a fan of the Excel spreadsheets than watching the games, very ready to join the ranks of the blog boys.
Yeah, no, it's not really. I think the whole. I tend to do it, but I think the whole watching thing is a little overrated. It's really just about going on NBA.com, going on RNBA. And as long as you see the stats, I don't even have to know what any of the players look like. I did not watch one Kobe Bryant game throughout his career, and I could tell you why he wasn't a top 10 player in NBA history. I will stand by that for the rest of eternity. All right, let's get to it. The Brooklyn Nets, a 119-111 victory over the Milwaukee Bucks. And I guess some people would say it was a little hyperbolic that I called it their best win post-All-Star break. I would remind them that the Nets haven't won many games post-All-Star break. I didn't go back and look, but I guess it's around four, probably maybe five, that they've won post-All-Star break. And this was pretty awesome on a night that they didn't have Damari Carroll, they didn't have Dante Cunningham. Guys just stepped up across the board. Obviously, Alan Crabb hitting the two incredibly difficult late three-pointers to ice this one, 25 points, 7 rebounds. D'Angelo Russell, he got off to extremely hot start, three threes in the first 10 minutes, 22-5. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, 14-11-5, 4 blocks, excellent defense, 17-6, and some clutch shooting for Joe Harris. Three different guys on the bench scoring at least 9 points. I love what Quincy Acey did. I love what Spencer Dinwiddie did. I love what Caris LeVert did. Timofey Mozgov scoring his first bucket in literally 2 months. That's incredible. Jared Allen defending the rim. It was just more of a team effort than I've seen for the Nets in months and months and months. Maybe, like, if you just look in terms of balance across the board, their best team effort all season. Jeremy, I'm going way too long. What did you think about it?
Well, first of all, one of the great joys of the Nets having traded their pick is that you don't get that, oh no, why are you winning feeling that you do with a tanking team.
Just superb, yeah.
I'm so unused to this because I'm a Jets fan, so I was watching and the whole time I was thinking, why are you winning? And then I realized, oh, they can actually, like, try.
Yeah.
Because there's no downside. So, no. You know, I guess they've got that going for them. But I was very excited by, like you were saying, the team effort. I think one thing that was interesting was just seeing the Nets play so much above their talent and seemingly the talent level and seemingly really playing as a cohesive unit against sort of a mirror opposite in the Bucks, who seemed like they were playing as five guys on five different teams on the same floor for much of the game.
Yeah.
And really ended up punching below their talent level as a result.
No.
I was excited by it.
No, yeah. No, you're 100% right about that. And it was funny because, like, when the Bucks, like, just kind of got their crap together, they just started dunking all over the Nets, and they had these two, like, massive runs, one in the first half, one in the second, each time to take control of the basketball game, that the Nets were just more steady in. And to me, at least, like, the big stat outside of all the numbers I just recited on the Nets side is Giannis Antetokounmpo and Jabari Parker combining to go 13 of 42 from the field. That's absolutely stunning, especially with the way Giannis has just dominated this Nets team all year. And the Bucks have been, and I think to me this is really what seals it up as kind of the game of the post All-Star break season for the Nets. The Bucks had been utterly dominant against Brooklyn when they played this year. They've outscored them by a combined 44 points in the first quarters of their previous two meetings. So it just gives you an idea of what kind of matchup problems they pose for the Nets with their athletic ability across the board. But I think you nailed it on the head, Jeremy. That talent advantage didn't really overcome the Nets' cohesiveness tonight. And I wonder who would you kind of give credit to on the Nets for that cohesiveness? It just seemed like Kenny Atkinson really had them ready to go, but the ball movement was on point in a way that it hasn't been in recent memory for the Nets. And to me, that was kind of the deciding factor if you want to look at it holistically.
Right. I mean, I strongly agree with you. First of all, I give a ton of credit to Kenny. I think he's a great coach, very underrated, and I'm excited for him going forward. But I agree that I thought the ball movement was stunning for much of the game, and I kind of couldn't tell like how much of it was the Nets just really always giving up a good shot or a great shot, always looking for the next guy open, versus how much of it was the Bucks seeming like they had never played together before.
Yeah, it's a big
deal. And often having three guys on one net, not deliberately, just because no one knows where to stand or people are playing lazy defense and then trying to recover. But the Nets definitely exploited it all game. I like that, you know, often with sort of younger teams or teams that are not playoff bound, you'll sometimes see that ball movement early in the game against a sloppy opponent, but then they'll get bogged down as the game goes on and win. I like that the Nets kept the ball moving all four quarters, kept looking for the open man. And I think that played a big part in something you were saying about D'Angelo Russell having had one of his most encouraging games this year.
Yeah, no, he was excellent to start this one, and it's been a rough stretch for him, obviously getting benched in that Miami game and then not playing really all that well in the two ensuing ones against the Sixers and Pistons. Tonight, 9 of 16 from the field, 4 of 10 from three, and that was with a cold finish. He still had 22 points and 5 assists. His shooting early in the game, I really think, is what stopped this from potentially being a blowout, and I give him a lot of credit because he's been a guy that just hasn't necessarily played with the energy and fire you would like to see, or at least hasn't had that consistently. And he absolutely set the tone in the first quarter of this one. And that was the big fear if you were the Nets coming into this: oh, the Bucks are just going to run us over again, and it's going to be over before we can even blink. And Russell didn't allow that to happen, hitting those threes, but also some really tough shot making inside. There were plays where he got switched onto guys and had a Jabari Parker or a Giannis on him and took them to the basket and hit running shots over them. Other ones where he had Eric Bledsoe on him, and he got to take advantage of his size and use that to hit mid-range jumpers. So I really loved his aggressiveness in the early going and his ability to both score and set up his teammates. I felt really set the tone for the Nets in this one. All right, we're going to get more into the individual performances, but first, a quick break to thank some sponsors. Welcome back into the Locked On Nets podcast. We are celebrating no journalistic integrity here, a 119-111 Nets victory over the Milwaukee Bucks. Gavin Shaw, guest co-host Jeremy Kaplet, bringing it to you. All right, so we just kind of got into D'Angelo Russell. I want to talk Allen Crabb a little bit because he was a guy who obviously had a very disappointing first 50 or so games of the season, then really turned it around going into All-Star break, a little bit after All-Star break, scoring the basketball really well, shooting the three-pointer better, and becoming a lot more aggressive, making plays both off the dribble and on the defensive end. But the shooting's kind of come and gone in the second half of the season, coming into this one just 25% from three over his previous four games. And then tonight, initially, he wasn't shooting it that well, and to me, it was kind of the same symptom or I guess cause of issue that it has been for the last couple of games, and it's that his three-pointer seem to be getting further and further out, and he's just kind of losing his legs as the season goes on, and that's forced him to kind of go back to the wind-up style of shooting he had earlier in the year instead of just flicking it, which is how he shoots when he's in rhythm. And then somehow later in this game, he rediscovered it, ended up hitting four threes in the second half of this one, including just an insane 4-point play to beat a shot clock buzzer. And then the two at the end were absolutely stunning. It was 105-105, and he had an inbound with about 3 seconds left on the shot clock, sent it into Jared Allen, went sprinting out to catch it. Guy right in his face just flicks it over him and in, and then with 118 left, hits another big one. So he essentially won this game for the Nets. And Jeremy, I'm interested from an outside perspective, what you think about Allen Crabbe both this season and this game specifically, because I know me and Josh, I think, got down on him early and didn't necessarily give him a fair chance to win our hearts back. And obviously he's had his inconsistencies, but was really, really good tonight.
Well, for one thing, I mean, obviously he's a streaky player. And so being streaky is going to look much worse on a bad team, but let's say a developing team like the Nets, than it will on, you know, a team like the Cavs or the Warriors, a contender, where you can let someone go off if they're going off, and then you can hide their weaknesses when they're going through a slump. So, you know, I think that spotlight is probably part of why it looks so glaring for those parts of the season, like you were saying, where he loses his rhythm, because they're really depending on his three-point shooting as an integral part of having just a basic functional offense. But one thing I liked that you mentioned, obviously, of course, making clutch threes at the end of games over defenders is a good thing.
Yeah, it's positive quality. I pride myself on it.
But a lesser attribute that I like that you mentioned, you said that he was attacking more. And I noticed that a little bit in the first half, actually, a little bit more of that attacking mentality. And that's really important for the Nets because they don't have an explosive creator who can just sort of get to the rim instantly, hit a guy open in his shooting pocket, and create a play in the span of 3 or 4 seconds. But when they have everybody sort of attacking the rim early in the shot clock, they can create a scrambling defense and sort of more slowly work to get that open shot.
Yeah.
But then, of course, sometimes it just comes down to, like you're saying, at the end of a game, shooting over somebody, rediscovering your form, like you're saying, getting into that sort of instinct rhythm when the game is on the line. And It was awesome. It was incredible. He really put the team on his back, like you said.
Yeah, no, I think tonight kind of epitomized that point you just made on Crabbe about how essential his shooting is, especially when they don't have a Damari Carroll and they don't have a Dante Cunningham off the bench. Like, he had to hit three incredibly high degree of difficulty shots for the Nets to win this game. And if he misses just one of those, I know they ended up winning by 8 after free throws and everything, but this game could have gone dramatically differently down the stretch. So I really think he saved them. And to your other point about shot creation, it was that kind of night where it took a lot of guys probing and making really smart plays off the dribble. I think about Joe Harris finishing with 6 assists tonight, like not a number he normally gets to. And he was just constantly like picking out cutters and hitting guys on threes and just making really smart drives with the ball. And a lot of times that was secondary creation set off by either D'Angelo Russell or Spencer Dinwiddie, who's been so quiet of late, making really strong reads and attacking the basket with some consistency. So I think it was kind of a system that needed everyone to play a part to work, and especially against a Bucks defense that has so much length and at times won with that length, creating quite a few turnovers against the Nets. They needed to be on point, and they weren't for the entire game, but I guess that battle tilted just enough in their favor that it was enough for them to win this game.
And on that note, actually, I like what you mentioned about how important secondary creation was today, because there were a lot of situations where, as I mentioned, you know, not having a John Wall or a Russell Westbrook who has the body control to get to the rim quickly and then make an accurate pass on the fly, there were a lot of times where someone would probe, get inside the paint, and then make a pass to an open shooter, an inaccurate pass to an open shooter that would allow a recovery, but that shooter would then react to the recovery, and instead of just trying to force the shot up, the catch and shoot up, they would take the scrambling defender, continue attacking until eventually they would work their way to an easier pass and a more in-rhythm shot. And the question becomes, how capable will the Nets be of translating this performance into a similar sort of high-effort team basketball effort against a defense that might be more in sync and that might not have such an obvious difficulty helping and recovering.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a little bit of a catch-22 because the Bucks kind of force you to play that style of basketball at their defense, and it's so interesting from a Milwaukee perspective because in some ways they dictate the way offenses play night in and night out, and on the surface you'd be like, oh, that's a good thing, but what they do is they force teams into moving the basketball, and just because they're so long on defense and there's so much athletic ability there, you have to make those passes and you have to beat scrambling defenders and you have to use the entirety of the shot clock just waiting to find the best possible shot. And the Nets lived and died by that ethos this entire night. Like, there were a couple really bad shot clock violations. Like, I thought that one from Rondae Hollis-Jefferson driving from the corner would end the game, and then the very next play he is the exact same scenario where he's attacking with about 3 seconds left on the shot clock, and in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, he's going to panic here because he just committed a shot clock violation in this very same situation. They absolutely need a bucket. So I figured he was just going to throw up a runner that would probably have been off, and that could have turned the game. And instead, he kicks out this beautiful pass to Joe Harris, who hits a big three right at the top of the key. And that changed the basketball game. So it was just the Nets living and dying on those margins this entire night. And I think you're right to question it because they haven't been playing like this a lot. And just the way the Bucks defense plays you, it forces you to move the basketball and make those types of plays. So I'm wondering if this was something that Atkinson emphasized knowing they were going against this type of defense, or just something that came up naturally in terms of play. I guess ultimately it doesn't matter that much, but I think it's interesting nonetheless.
But one thing that also surprised me was the Bucks seemed, in my mind, to start the game almost like they were breathing a sigh of relief that they just clinched the playoffs, as we know. And they didn't seem like they were taking the Nets that seriously. And I find that mind-boggling because they do realize that they could still avoid the Raptors and play the Kyrie-less Celtics, right?
Yeah, no, and that's obviously a very big deal. How are
they playing with more enthusiasm? The like you were saying in our text chat, the coaching malpractice is just unbelievable.
Yeah, no, and I don't know. I don't know what to make of them because, again, there's so much – there's just so much talent there, and there's a reason you hear from guys like Zach Lowe, and just about every NBA reporter has said at one point or another, the most desired job in basketball this offseason will be the Milwaukee Bucks, and if you can find a way to, and it seems relatively simple on the surface because people have been pointing this out for years and years and years now, to kind of tone down that defense just a little bit. And as a lot of people pointed out, you could tone it down and they could still be the most aggressive defense in the NBA. I think you have the makings of a great defensive team there. John Henson, a solid rim protector. Eric Bledsoe, when he's locked in, as good as anyone at the point guard position. Giannis, a destroyer across the floor. And obviously you go to the bench and things patter out a little bit, but you fill out that bench with the right type of guys and you just have that starting five out there with some consistency. There's no reason they can't be one of the best defensive teams in basketball. And I think Giannis by himself, surrounded by Middleton, Bledsoe, and Parker, assuming he ends up back on this team next year, you should be an above league average offense just on talent alone. So I think there's the makings there for a top four seed in the East. And I'm fascinated to see if they get the right coach and the front office does their job. I think there's going to be a lot of great battles between them and the 76ers and throw the Celtics in there too over the next 5-10 years.
And since you mentioned that defensive style, I think one really good model that they should be looking at would be the 2013 Heat, because that was sort of around the time that Spoelstra transitioned them to this really aggressive blitzing style that became a hallmark of their sort of defensive transformation during that dynasty run. And the key catalyst in that defense is having someone like LeBron, who has the unreal combination of athleticism and speed and size to rush out and then harass someone enough that they can't make an easy pass or attack the basket. And Giannis fits that prototype to a T. Now, obviously, the Heat also had Chris Bosh, who became an incredibly cerebral defender during that time and was really adept at knowing exactly when to drop back, exactly how far to push out. But if there's any team in the league that can look at their roster and say, hey, we have long athletic bigs who we can sort of train to fill that role, it should be the Bucks.
Yeah. And I think Bledsoe's a key component there too, because I think he could kind of play the Dwayne Wade role, at least on the defensive end. Okay, well, we're going to take one final break. Coming back, We will be discussing the defensive performances of Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Jared Allen. And then I didn't tell Jeremy we were going to talk about this, but I want to talk about his transition from Nets fandom to Knicks fandom, because it's a controversial topic, both in our friend group and I think soon amongst our podcast fans after they hear the story. So we'll get into that. Welcome back in one last time to the Locked On Nets podcast. Gavin Shaw, precocious neophyte, Jeremy Caplet, manning the reins. Shout out to Josh Bass, our boy, had the night off. The Nets, 119, Milwaukee, 111. I don't know why I have to say the score every time. I feel like people probably remember it, but I keep doing it anyways.
Maybe just because it's so shocking.
Yeah, it's the broadcaster in me, too. You have to do it every 2 seconds. Anyways, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Jared Allen. I'm so impressed by what they did on the defensive end in this game, combining for 9 blocks against the, as we said, the lengthiest and one of the bounciest teams in the NBA. And I loved what Rondae did against Giannis Antetokounmpo. I know Ian Eagle mentioned early in the game that Damari Carroll and Dante Cunningham would usually be two fairly logical guys to throw at Antetokounmpo, though I think he would have torched Cunningham. But Carroll in particular, someone who typically would have guarded him the majority of the game for the Nets. But I thought Hollis-Jefferson is actually, like, if you're building someone to guard Giannis, like, I am, like, unless you have another Giannis, like, he's about as good as you're going to get with his combination of size and I guess foot speed. I think he's the perfect guy to throw at him. And you could tell he took the assignment really, really seriously, only taking 6 shots in 37 minutes, but really focusing his efforts on the defensive end. And that was one of the key factors in this one. Giannis going just 7 of 21 from the floor, and eventually when it got down to crunch time, you saw he didn't even want to go into the lane anymore. And part of that was because the Nets helped Hollis-Jefferson out consistently with really smart doubles, and Allen was having a field day at the rim blocking shots. So it was a team effort as well, but I like that they wore Giannis down and got in his head a little bit. And for a kid that's just been totally unstoppable this whole season, like, the Nets of all teams making an impact on him. So I wanted to give those two a shout out.
And no, I'm totally with you on Jared Allen in particular, not just his blocks, but also his boards. In particular, you know, he got the 10 rebounds today, and those were not easy rebounds. These were not sort of everyone's already cleared out, cheap, you know, I'm just the only guy around grabbing the ball. A lot of them were, there were a few contested offensive rebounds, which I think plays into what you're describing about wearing down the other team, because it's just so demoralizing when, you know, not only are you struggling on defense, but then you finally either you get a stop or you get lucky and someone misses that open three. And then Jared Allen is just hounding dudes down low, making them work to end the possession. And on the defensive end as well, just sort of being that stopper, making sure that you can't build momentum or get back in the game by getting easy offensive rebounds, just really being sort of a force in that way, I think, plays into what you were describing about not just wearing the other team down, but also you mentioned earlier that D'Angelo Russell's shooting helped prevent Milwaukee from going on the kind of run that could have ended the game. I think Jared Allen's rebounding serves a similar function of just stopping those sort of momentum-building sequences in their tracks. And I particularly appreciate that from him because as a rookie facing the rookie wall, you know, he can't just shoot through it like Kyle Kuzma or Donovan Mitchell, but he can do this. He can just work his ass off and put himself in a position to still be a difference maker.
No, I think that's a really astute observation. And again, it's like, it's what they're going to need him to do. They're going to, like, need him to play big boy basketball. And obviously, like, this wasn't one of those games where he's just going up against a behemoth that he can't physically match up with. Like, I'm thinking like Joel Embiid, Andre Drummond, Dwight Howard, like guys that have given the Nets a lot of trouble this year. But with all the length the Bucks have out there, you were right, he was battling for his life. And without Dante Cunningham, the Nets a lot of time going small with Quincy Acey at the four or Rondae Hollis-Jefferson at the four. And that really did put an immense amount of pressure on Allen to have a big game in those two regards, and him and Hollis-Jefferson combining for 21 rebounds and 9 blocks. We talk about crab shooting, and we talk about Dinwiddie and D'Lo keeping the offense alive, and Joe Harris making a bunch of key shots. But that was that just as much as anything else that defined the game. And to me, you take all those things into account. That's why I say this was maybe the Nets' best team effort. I'll even take out the post All-Star game qualifier, maybe all season. And I kept. I kept saying there was this need for them to get this big team win before the end of the year, and I thought they blew it, not really showing up against the Sixers and then losing really close games back-to-back against the Raptors and Cavs before that. But to me, even though the Milwaukee obviously isn't on the level of those teams, just given the disparity in their previous matchups, this represented that significant of a win. All right, we're approaching 25 minutes, so we're going to wrap this one up. But before I let Jeremy off the hot seat, I just had to ask, Jeremy, you grew up a New Jersey Nets fan. There's no amount of revisionist history that can make me forget that. We've been friends since, I believe, the summer going into fourth grade. So I distinctly remember the old New Jersey Nets gear all around your house. And I believe it was sometime in the middle of high school, you just woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm a Knicks fan. Well, how did that happen?
Well, so a few things changed. Sure. First and foremost, a lot of liking the Nets just had to do with, as you know, my stepdad, Corey, big Nets fan. And I think part of why he got into them is he was working in New Jersey and he realized, like, hey, nobody loves this team that's like a serious finals contender.
Yeah.
And that makes no sense. And they're really fun to watch. And Jason Kidd is like blowing past fools and nobody shows up to the games. And I kind of bought into that kitsch. And, so, you know, the move to Brooklyn definitely took some of the air out. And then there's also just, I don't know, realizing I lived in New York and not New Jersey.
Yeah. And now not Brooklyn. Yeah, I guess they were like more like counterculture when they were in New Jersey, and like it's weird. Like maybe like I don't know. I'd be interested to go back and see like the relative attendance figures, like the years they were making the finals. Like I'm assuming the crowds were pretty good, and then like when they got Vince Carter, like they were just such a fun team. Like you think that they were drawing people, but it's interesting because I remember there's that iconic poster of like Vince doing like a reverse dunk in transition that are just him like flying through the air, and like the backdrop is just an empty Prudential Center, and it's really like it's amazing and stunning, and it's like it's just, I mean, it's really cool like artistically, but just the idea that like no one was there to watch that freak of nature in his prime just tear up the league is kind of stunning. So I see where you're coming from, and then they move to Brooklyn and they get these like black and white jerseys that some people think are really cool and stylish, but to me, I apologize. I know I'm taking shots at Brooklyn here, and I'm probably going to lose half our listeners, but it was like all style, like not a lot of substance, which I'm sure they would say about Manhattan probably fairly to some degree.
They did give us the Brooklyn Night, though. Never forget.
Oh, yeah. Daft Punk running around with a sword. That was great. It was the first few years of the Brooklyn Nets were like, it was so stupid. And then like, and obviously like that whole,
it was insufferable. And now they're like much more of like a normal team.
Yeah. Well, because it's just funny because like the pressure of that move is, I mean, I think at least to some degree what caused Billy King to make what ended up being like one of the five worst trades in NBA history and mortgaging the Nets' entire future for over the hill, Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett. So it's interesting to look back on, maybe something we'll explore more this offseason, but I appreciate the transparency on your process, Jeremy. And I know you're an enemy of Nets Nation, but us Knicks fans welcome you with open arms, and I appreciate you being on this podcast.
To clarify for your listeners, sure. Since I sound like such a Fairweather fan right now,
yeah,
I'd like to point out I'm still rocking the Mark Sanchez jersey, so I may not be as much of a diehard when it comes to, you know, Knicks versus Nets. I'll be happy for either, but I want to clarify that I'm very excited for the Giants to take Josh Allen in this upcoming draft and gift the next 20 years of Josh Rosen to my beloved incompetent.
As you know, that would torture me, and I'd love to see the Jets take him. I would no longer acknowledge football's existence as a sport, which would be a problem given my potential continued employment at the NFL. But that's neither here nor there. Jeremy, appreciate you coming on and filling Josh's shoes. All right, that is it for this edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. Just 3 games left now for Brooklyn. Absolutely insane to think about. Next one is against the Bulls this Saturday. We will have full coverage of that for you sometime Sunday. I'm not 100% sure when, but it'll happen. Jeremy will probably make an appearance sometime this offseason, so shout out to him. And we're done because I've done 3 wrap-ups. Peace.